From East Timor, this is Democracy Now!
Terrorism has a definition. It means it refers to the terrorism that others carry out against us. If we carry out against them at 1,000 times the level, that's not terrorism.
Scholar and activist Noam Chomsky and reporter Robert Fisk of the Independent newspaper in Britain. He's based in Beirut. All that and more coming up. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting from an internet cafe in Dili, East Timor. First, the headlines. The Indian Prime Minister has told frontline troops in the disputed territory of Kashmir to prepare for a decisive battle against Islamic insurgents. Meanwhile, masked men assassinated prominent Pakistani Kashmiri separatist Abdul Ghani Lone during a rally yesterday. Ghani Lone was a moderate from the all-party Hurriyat Alliance who opposed violence and called for dialogue. Pakistan blamed Delhi for the murder. Israel's parliament has passed emergency spending cuts in order to pay for the recent military attacks on the West Bank. When members of the ultra-Orthodox Shas party refused to support the measure earlier this week, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon dismissed them from the party, launching his coalition government into crisis. The Shas members were not present at today's vote. Meanwhile, Israeli forces killed two Palestinians near Jenin and Bethlehem in the south. A suicide bomber blew himself up this morning near border policemen near Jenin. The bomber was killed in the blast, but none of the policemen were injured. The Israeli government agreed yesterday to build nearly 1,000 houses in Jewish settlements near Jerusalem, sparking protests from Israeli peace groups and Palestinian officials. In the United States, the Justice Department disclosed it will file suit in three Florida counties and municipalities in Tennessee and Missouri, charging voting rights violations in the 2000 presidential election. Ralph Boyd, Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, told the Senate Judiciary Committee he expects the counties and municipalities to admit wrongdoing and to agree to take steps to prevent recurrences of problems in the 2002 elections. Boyd said the allegations include improper purges of voter rolls, disparate treatment of minorities in the voting process, failures to provide required voter registration material in certain public places, and inaccessible balloting for disabled voters. Critics charge the suits, which will not seek to overturn the 2000 elections but will recommend limited remedies, or an attempt to fend off stronger electoral reform by Congress. Congress's first subpoena to the Bush White House for information on staff contacts with Enron Corporation officials is being prepared by Democrats on the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee. The White House asked Senator Lieberman on Tuesday to withdraw his threat of a subpoena for the information, saying the administration is cooperating and is gathering documents. The committee is voting today on whether to authorize a subpoena as part of its investigation of Enron, which filed the biggest corporate bankruptcy in U.S. history. The Houston-based company has been among Bush's biggest campaign contributors. The House of Representatives unanimously passed a resolution congratulating the people of East Timor on their independence and welcoming the new nation as a, quote, equal partner in the community of nations. The resolution calls for maintaining, quote, a level of U.S. assistance for East Timor commensurate with the challenges this new nation faces after independence. The House also urged the Bush administration to, quote, ensure that those officials responsible for crimes against humanity and war crimes against the East Timorese people are held accountable, and expressed its commitment to maintaining a suspension of U.S. military aid to Indonesia. A study of ABC World News Tonight, CBS Evening News, and NBC Nightly News in the year 2001 shows that 92% of all U.S. sources interviewed were white, 85% male, 75% Republican. The study conducted by the media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting shows the big three nightly news shows rely heavily on society's most powerful groups when they report the news of the day. Big business, too, was overrepresented in a year in which the country lost 2.4 million jobs. Corporate representatives appeared about 35 times more frequently than did union representatives.
What is it good for? closer to me. Oh, whoa, I despise.
You're listening to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio, broadcasting from Dili, East Timor. I'm Amy Goodman. The State Department has issued a report accusing seven nations of, quote, sponsoring terrorism. These include Cuba, Libya, Syria, Sudan, Iran, North Korea, and Iraq. The annual report also noted that terrorist attacks claimed a record number of lives in 2001. September 11th was responsible for 90% of them. The articles about the report do not explain how its authors determine what is a terrorist attack and what is not, but it seems clear from the tallies that the thousands killed in the bombing of Afghanistan do not count as victims of terrorism, nor do those killed in Palestine by Israeli soldiers wielding U.S. weapons. American crimes are simply not considered crimes. Well, we're going to turn now to a speech by scholar Noam Chomsky on the long and bloody history of U.S.-sponsored terrorism. He gave this speech at Stanford University in mid-March, just days after the six-month anniversary of the September 11th attacks. Noam Chomsky is a professor emeritus at MIT, world-renowned linguist and political analyst.
In the last couple of years, I've been in the thousands of talks I give all over the place. I've found myself kind of reluctantly giving talks about endangered species, meaning by that things like democracy, human rights, socioeconomic development, others. But the prime one, unfortunately, is human beings, ourselves. I think there's a very serious threat to survival. It's not a joke. It's following from, it's as a consequence of policies that have a great deal of elite support, a lot of popular opposition, overwhelming popular opposition, but more ominously, they're rational policies. That is, rational within a framework of ideological and socioeconomic institutions that exist and are pretty stable. And within that framework, policies leading almost inexorably to self-destruction do appear rational and are being pursued. I want to talk about some of these. These are not going to be things that are, actually I've been giving quite a few talks here in the last couple of days in this area, and they've mostly been on topical matters, but I want to turn to things that are maybe, in my view, more important. They do involve issues of survival, but are not on the front pages. They ought to be. However, first, I will say a couple of words about things that are on the front pages. These concerns have been put to the side in the last several months at least in public discussion, by the threat of international terrorism, which compels us to peer into the abyss of the future. That's a title. I'm supposed to be careful about plagiarism these days, and that's plagiarism. I took it from a full-page headline of in the New York Times about September 11th. Well, September 11th was undoubtedly a major atrocity, major terrorist atrocity, and it was regarded that way throughout the world, virtually without exception. However, sometimes it is useful to pay a little bit of attention to what people are saying outside the little cocoon of rich and privileged and powerful people within which most of us spend all our lives. Me too. And in fact, there were interesting things to say outside of that about international terrorism. It was, for example, in Central America and the Middle East, which have had considerable experience with international terrorism, described as a plague spread by depraved opponents of civilization itself, in a return to barbarism in the modern age, so on. I happen to be quoting Secretary of State George Shultz. He was the moderate of the Reagan administration, some of you will remember. They came to office 20 years ago declaring that the war against international terrorism was going to be the focus of U.S. foreign policy, and particularly they would concentrate on Central America and the Middle East, which they described as the center of the operations of the depraved opponents of civilization itself. Well, it's interesting that we haven't heard anything about this in the last 6 months after the war on terrorism was redeclared on September 11th. It wasn't declared. It was the same war with the same rhetoric, actually even the same people, if you look. Probably it'll be carried out about the same way, has been so far. But nothing has been said about this not very ancient history, although in places like the Central America and the Middle East, they haven't forgotten it that quickly. The places where the war against terrorism was focused. In Central America and the Middle East, they have memories, like they have memories of the fact that the defenders of civilization launched terrorist campaigns of unprecedented scale and violence in both areas, in Central America and the Middle East, which just overwhelmed any other terrorism that might be taking place there by orders of magnitude. And this they do remember, undoubtedly. I just happened to return a couple of weeks ago from the site of one of the more recent international terrorist campaigns, namely southeastern Turkey, where there was a savage assault against the population beginning in the mid-80s, peaking in the 1990s. During the Clinton years, some of the worst atrocities and the ethnic cleansing of the 1990s, far worse than anything that Milosevic is being tried for, connection with Kosovo. 2 or 3 million people made refugees, a couple of thousand towns and villages destroyed, tens of thousands of people killed, Kurds, this Turkish campaign against the Kurds. Every imaginable form of torture and barbarism. It's all well reported in human rights reports and scholarly literature and so on. Of course, they know all about it. It's international terrorism because we paid for it. It was all done with the military and economic and doctrinal support, diplomatic support of the United States, first by the Reagan-Bush administrations, but then peaking under Clinton. In fact, in the year 1997 alone, Turkey, that single year, Turkey received more U.S. military aid than in the entire period from the beginning of the Cold War up till the onset of the counterinsurgency campaign in the mid-80s combined. Now, it's absolutely nothing to do with the Cold War. It's just straight, outright international terrorism, organized, paid for, supported, encouraged in Washington. Primarily by Clinton. He ended up providing 80% of the arms, Turkey, in fact, became the leading recipient of U.S. Arms outside of Israel and Egypt by the end of the 1990s. By 1999, it was replaced by Colombia as the leader, and that's the focus of the next major war against terror, which will be very much like the earlier ones. You can be sure of that, and they don't doubt it. Well, the repression of the Kurds had been far worse than anything bad as Kosovo might have been. It was far worse than anything reported there and remained so right up until the present moment. It's a kind of dungeon for millions of people now. You may have read in the papers today or heard on NPR as I did driving somewhere that for the first time Afghans were able to celebrate the Persian New Year. Great celebration about that, and it's a good thing. Not for the reasons they talked about, but you know, we can be happy that they did that. In The same celebration takes place in Kurdish areas, in all the sort of Kurdish-Persian areas everywhere, except southeastern Turkey, where it was banned by the Turkish government. A couple of people killed, big demonstrations. United States is now sending Turkey to fight the war on terror in Afghanistan in gratitude for their achievements of the 1990s and conducting some of the worst terrorist atrocities of those years. And in fact, that is regarded as a model. So if you read State Department reports or the front page of the New York Times, articles by their terrorism experts, they laud Turkey for having shown, for having demonstrated how one should deal with terrorism and serve as a model for the future, and therefore they're the ones who should take responsibility for fighting the war on terror in Afghanistan. Now, this is quite a tribute to the servility, I guess is the right word, of the educated classes in the West. All of this passes without notice. Virtually none of it was reported, still isn't reported. Beyond just suppressing the fact, they are even lauded for the achievement of conducting some of the worst international terrorism of the last few years. Serving now as a model to how to conduct the war against terror. Well, there's nothing here surprises anyone in Central America or the Middle East, or in fact most of the world, because they're quite familiar with how wars against terror are carried out. All of this simply illustrates what ought to be a complete truism. Terrorism has a definition. It means it refers to the terrorism that others carry out against us. If we carry out against them at 1,000 times the level, that's not terrorism. And furthermore, it's not, that's in the United States, that's universal. You can try hard to find an exception to it in the scholarly literature or journalism or everything else, but it's not just the United States. As far as I know, it's universal. I think it's a historical universal. I can't find an incident in modern or past history when that hasn't been true. So if you take the worst, you know, the worst mass murderers who existed, say the Nazis in occupied Europe, take a look at their propaganda, they were defending the population against the terrorism of the resistance, which was directed and supported from abroad, and defending the legitimate governments like Vichy against these terrorists. And like all propaganda, there's a certain element of truth to it. Nobody doubted that the partisans were being directed and supported from London and Washington. That's perfectly open. And they undoubtedly carried out terrorist acts. If you can think of a resistance movement in history that didn't, I'd like to hear about it. It's not to say that it's a good thing, but it's just a fact. So there was some truth to the Nazi propaganda that they were fighting a war against terror, and we can take pride in the fact that we're in good company. It's not all that different. As I say, I don't know of any exceptions. I presume if we had records from Attila the Hun, we'd probably find the same thing. If anybody can think of an exception, I'd like to hear it. I'd add it as a footnote somewhere.
Professor Noam Chomsky speaking in mid-March at Stanford University. We'll be back with him, followed by Robert Fisk, in just a minute.
I was born by the river in a little tent, and just like the river been running ever since. He said it's been a long time coming, but I know my change is gonna come. Oh yeah. He said it's been too.
You are are listening to Democracy Now!, broadcasting live from East Timor, which Noam Chomsky has written about for the last quarter of a century. But today he's talking about state-sponsored terrorism around the world. He gave this speech at Stanford University in mid-March.
Some of these things remain in memory, some don't, and they follow the principle. So, for example, on March 11th, there were solemn ceremonies around the country, very well reported, commemorating the six-month anniversary of the atrocities of the World Trade Center. That was a serious terrorist attack, undoubtedly. It's the first terrorist attack first violent attack against the national territory of the United States since 1814, when the British burned down Washington, and every December 7th, and that's justified, you should commemorate that. On every December 7th, we commemorate an attack against military bases in two U.S. colonies on 1941, and yes, those are terrorist atrocities or aggression as well, and that makes sense. We should commemorate those crimes. There are others that pass without mention. For example, this month, which happened March of 2002, happens to be the 40th anniversary of March 1962. That was the month in which the Kennedy administration publicly announced that it was sending the U.S. Air Force to bomb South Vietnam and initiate chemical warfare to destroy food crops, authorized napalm, began the project of driving hundreds of thousands of people. It ended up being maybe 10 million people into concentration camps and slums, try to overcome indigenous resistance. That's 40 years this month. Haven't noticed any commemorations or any reference to it. And the reason is it's kind of like the atrocities in Southeast Turkey. It didn't happen. And it didn't happen because we did it. And since we did it, it's not a crime. In fact, it's not even part of history. As far as I know, that one is even lauded as a noble cause and a noble achievement. Left millions of South Vietnam was the main target of the U.S. attack all the way through. Ended up practically destroyed the rest of the Indochina along with it. Millions of corpses. Nobody knows within millions, literally, what the number of dead was. Because of another principle, you don't investigate your own crimes. You investigate other people's crimes with, you know, laser-like intensity, but your own, since they don't exist, there's no need to investigate them, and we don't even know. In fact, among the general public, information is so slight that the one study I know of that was done to try to see what people thought, you know, so what's your guess as to how many Vietnamese victims there were? Turns out the mean guess is 100,000. That's as if in Germany now, if you ask people how many Jews were killed in the Holocaust, and the mean guess was maybe 200,000. If that happened in Germany, we'd think there's a problem there. You know, if you got results like that. Well, we don't think there's a problem here because Germany was defeated and therefore they have to face the facts of what they did. But the United States has always been victorious 100% of the time. And when you're always victorious, it's very bad for the character. Part of the defect is you just don't pay attention to what you did to other people. So therefore you don't have to worry about how the first war on terror was waged or how this one's being waged or the fact that some of the major terrorist atrocities of just the last few years are, in fact, not only the atrocities overlooked, they're actually lauded as successes in counterterror, and the agent of them is praised. Sometimes it takes real effort to ignore these things. So you may have seen a couple of days ago, I think I've got the clipping here, March 11th, there was a front page story in the New York Times, probably the San Francisco Chronicle, big headline says, "Some see panic as main effect of dirty bombs." Some Federation of American Scientists discovered that radioactive materials that are in quite wide use in the United States, radioactive cobalt rods that are used to irradiate food and so on, can be turned, in principle at least, into what they call dirty bombs. They could be spread over cities, say New York. They say that would these would be weapons of terror that would probably kill few people, but would spread panic and produce severe economic damage, would raise radiation levels above what's acceptable by the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, and would undoubtedly cause panic. So that's a front page story, and it should be, indicates the kind of abyss that we should be peering into. The couple of days before that, 3 days before that, the wire services reported, it was barely, had a friend do a database search, barely noted in the press, but all the wire services reported a conference going on in Vietnam, which had leading U.S. specialists on public health, mainly concerned with the effects of chemical warfare. This is not the possibility that a few people, might suffer from a dirty bomb in the future, but rather the chemical warfare of the years of the 1960s, beginning in March 1962. The leading U.S. specialist, a professor at the University of Texas, had been doing blood tests of dioxin levels around South Vietnam. North Vietnam was spared this particular atrocity. It was just the South that had the chemical warfare attacks beginning just 40 years ago. And he found dioxin levels up to 200 times above average. That's one of the most severe carcinogens. There is some investigation of this by foreign journalists. One of the leading Israeli reporters, very well-known and respected reporter, Amnon Kapeliuk, traveled through the region in 1988 and reported in Israel what he called hideous deformities among children, deformed fetuses in the hospitals, you know, horrible effects. He estimated at that time, 1988, about a quarter of a million victims. The public health specialist a couple of days ago pointed out that there's still new victims, so it's something very lasting. But again, that's not a crime. It's not like the possibility that some people might be affected by dirty bombs by terrorists in the future. This is just, you know, who knows how many, maybe a quarter of a million people affected by U.S. chemical warfare in South Vietnam, so therefore it isn't even worth mentioning. Actually, sometimes it is mentioned. About 10 years ago, there was an article in the New York Times in the science section by their Southeast Asia correspondent, Barbara Crosette, who pointed out that it's kind of a mistake for us not to investigate this question, because it's a perfect experimental situation. We have two genetically identical populations, North and South Vietnam, so we have a control group and a test group. One of them was subjected to intensive U.S. chemical warfare, the other was not, and if we investigated it, we might learn something that would be useful for us. So therefore, we're kind of overlooking a real opportunity by not paying any attention to this problem. The conception that maybe we ought to do something about it, like pay reparations or try to cure people or something, I mean, that is so remote from it's just unintelligible. The words don't mean anything. You can't say it in polite company. Well, those two stories differed in that one was a front page story and the other was unmentioned, and that again illustrates the principles. The principles are we don't commit any crimes. It's kind of a logical impossibility, and terrorism is what they do to us, not what we do to them. So therefore, it was unnecessary in the past 6 months to report anything about the history of terrorism. And if you look carefully, you'll find nothing. Nothing about the first war on terrorism, nothing about the fact that the same people who ran that one are running this one, and nothing about the fact that the U.S. was condemned for international terrorism in Central America by the World Court, would have been by the Security Council if it hadn't vetoed a resolution calling on all states to observe international law. The current leader of the war on terrorism is the only state in the world that has the happens to be both condemned by the highest international tribunal for international terrorism, but also happens to be the only state in the world that has vetoed a Security Council resolution calling on states to observe international law. Its assistance in the its coalition partners are leading terrorist states. Russia is delighted to join the war on terrorism to have authorization for its atrocities in Chechnya, same in China, same in Israel. Turkey stepped up repression, that's what I was there for, and is now honored by taking over the role of leading the war on terrorism in Afghanistan. All of this passes unnoticed, unmentioned. If you can find a word about it in the reams of paper that have poured out, I'd be surprised. I haven't. Well, that's inside the cocoon. We happen to be rich, privileged, victorious, powerful. We don't have any responsibility to pay any attention to what's going on in the world. Well, outside the cocoon, you hear different voices. So in Diyarbakir, where I was a couple of weeks ago in southeast Turkey, where the celebrations were just banned yesterday with troops and demonstrations and killings, they do condemn the September 11th atrocities. But they also remember very well their own suffering at our hands, which vastly exceeds anything that took place in September 11th, horrible as that was, and they still live under harsh military rule that relies crucially on U.S. support at every possible level. That means military support and also silence, which is major support for atrocities. In Central America, up and down the region, again, if you read the press, the atrocities of September 11th were condemned, but with memories. So in Panama, for example, one of the least affected countries, the press condemned the September 11th bombings the way everybody else did, atrocities the way everyone else did, but pointed out we're not unfamiliar with it. And they referred to Operation Just Cause, George Bush the first, who invaded Panama and in one bombing raid, attacking a poor barrio, a slum, Barrio Churillo, according to the Panamanians, killed a couple of thousand people in one raid. Well, we don't know anything about that since, again, it's our crime, so we don't look at it. But the Panamanian estimates are approximately 3,000 people killed in one bombing raid in Operation Just Cause, which was, you'll recall, an operation undertaken to kidnap kind of a minor thug whose crime was disobedience, not criminality. He carried out plenty of criminal acts. He was kidnapped, brought to the United States after the U.S. vetoed two Security Council resolutions, and carried out a few actions like the one I just described. He was tried, sentenced, he's now in jail, for crimes that he committed while he was on the CIA payroll, almost entirely. But that's, the Panamanians remember that, we don't. And they remember it when they condemn the crimes of September 11th. In Nicaragua, the journal of the research journal of the Jesuit University, which is the main research journal in Central America, they condemned the bombings and the atrocities of the World Trade Center and Pentagon of September 11th as, they said it could be called Armageddon, but we too have remember our own excruciating Armageddon, which left tens of thousands of people dead, devastated the country, may never recover, sort of gone down far below ever since the U.S. took it over again in 1990. It's now the second poorest country in the hemisphere after Haiti, which also remembers a number of things. For example, they remember that They've been the target of most U.S. intervention, military intervention in the 20th century, and are now the poorest country in the hemisphere. They also remember that right in the midst of all the furor about the unwillingness of the Taliban to hand over alleged criminals, suspected criminals, meaning that we have a right to bomb them because they don't want to hand these people over to us, that we refuse to provide any evidence and refuse to consider their offers of negotiation. Right while all this was going on, Haiti renewed its request for the extradition, a formal extradition, of a leading war criminal, Emmanuel Constant, who's happily living in New York. He was the head of the paramilitary forces that were responsible for killing maybe 4,000 or 5,000 people in the 1990s under a military junta, which was in fact supported by Bush number one and Clinton. And they've sentenced him in absentia. There's no problem in this case about finding evidence or finding the perpetrator. But the U.S. won't extradite him, nor will the press even report it because it's so insignificant. 4,000 or 5,000 black people. The reason why the U.S. refuses to extradite him, everyone presumes, is that if he is brought to Haiti and tried in person, he'll spill the beans on his CIA connections during the period in which he was running the atrocities. It's better to keep that quiet, even though it's not really all that controversial. Well, it's really easy to continue, and I'll stop. But this, we could go on for hours like this. These differences are, you know, it really takes discipline not to see them. They are so overwhelmingly transparent. And the fact that they are literally unmentioned is, again, a major tribute to our educational institutions. It takes, you have to give them credit for being able to create people like us. Me too, you know, go through these things and come out well trained so as not to see things that are so glaringly obvious and so humanly significant. You know, it's not like missing some triviality. We're talking about things of extraordinary importance. Well, that's international terrorism if we want to peer down that abyss, and that's what we'll see if we look there with our eyes open. Let me just continue a little, turn over to the Middle East again. That was Central America. After September 11th, some of the press, particularly the Wall Street Journal, did do what they should have done. They began investigating opinion in the region to find out why people, they were trying to find out the answer to George Bush's plaintive question, why do they hate us when we're so good? You know, how can that be?
Noam Chomsky speaking at Stanford University about state-sponsored terrorism. When we come back, journalist Robert Fisk. Stay with me.
Because I know the biggest crime is just to throw up your hands. Say this has nothing to do with me. I just wanna live as comfortably as I can. You gotta look outside your eyes. You gotta think outside your brain. You gotta walk outside your life to where the neighborhood changed. Tell me who's your boogeyman. That's who I will be. You don't have to like me for who I am, but we'll see what you're made of by what you make of me. I think it's absurd that you think I am the derelict daughter. You know, I fight fire with the world.
You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting from East Timor. The FBI has put New York City on high alert, warning authorities to be ready for a so-called terrorist attack against landmarks like the Statue of Liberty and the Brooklyn Bridge. The warning followed a flurry of similarly vague announcements by top administration officials, from the FBI's Robert Mueller to War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and Vice President Dick Cheney. The frenzy of alerts comes as the White House battles mounting criticism over its failure to act last summer on information that al-Qaeda was planning an attack inside the U.S. Until last week, Bush and his aides claimed intelligence experts had not advised them that domestic targets were considered at risk. They now admit the CIA warned the president of possible hijackings while he was vacationing at his Texas ranch last August. Also last week, the FBI acknowledged that an agent in Phoenix, Arizona, had written a memo last summer warning that members of al-Qaeda might be training at American flight schools. His memo was ignored. The sources said yesterday that FBI Chief Robert Mueller did not learn about the memo until several days after September 11th, nor did Attorney General John Ashcroft. As for Bush, senior officials said neither Ashcroft nor Mueller briefed the president until recently. As speculation mounts over what the White House did and did not know, journalist Robert Fisks asks another question: why this heinous act of terrorism targeting the United States? Robert Fisks writes for the Independent newspaper in Britain. He's been based in Beirut for a quarter of a century.
On December the 8th last year, I was attacked by a crowd of Afghan refugees in a village called Kila Abdullah, not far from the Pakistan-Afghan border. My car had broken down, and the Afghans, many of whom had lost relatives in the recent US bombing raids around Kandahar, decided to take out their rage upon me. I was beaten on the head with stones, kicked and cut. Rescue came from a religious man. I recall he had a turban, but I had so much blood in my eyes at the time that I could scarcely see him. Who escorted me, this man, to a Pakistani police van? Sitting in the Red Cross ambulance on its way to Quetta, I realized how carefully I was going to have to handle the frightening and very painful event which had just occurred, and which I knew would be reported by my fellow journalists. I did not wish to be the source of yet another Muslim bashing story, the lone Brit savagely assaulted by an angry mob of Afghans for no reason. I hate the what and where stories that leave out the why. Some context, I felt, had to be given to their fury, some reference to the fact that they had been most cruelly bereaved, that my sudden and very definitely Western appearance in the village represented for them the face of those who had just destroyed their loved ones. In every interview I gave, I therefore made this point. Indeed, I said, and later wrote in my own newspaper, The Independent, that if I was one of those grief-filled Afghan men, I too would have attacked Robert Fisks. Those who beat me, I wrote, were truly innocent of any crime except being the victim of the world. Almost every published and televised report mentioned the reasons behind the assault, except for the British newspaper Mail on Sunday, which used an agency story but then deleted my explanation. In the Mail, a mob of angry Afghans attacked me, but apparently without reason. Readers might have been excused for thinking that Afghans are always angry, primitive, generically violent, and thus prone to beat up foreigners on a whim, the classic Islamophobic response of anyone reading the Mail story. I should add that when this was actually happening, one young man went up to my driver and said in all seriousness, "Is this Mr. Bush?" But later reactions were even more interesting. Among a mass of letters that arrived from readers of The Independent, almost all of them expressing their horror at what had happened, came a few Christmas cards, all but one of them unsigned, expressing the writer's disappointment that the Afghans hadn't finished the job. The Wall Street Journal carried an article which said more or less the same thing, under the subhead, "A self-loathing multiculturalist gets his due." In it, Mark Stein wrote of my reaction that you'd have to have a heart of stone not to weep with laughter. "The Fisk Doctrine," he went on, "taken to its logical conclusion, absolves of responsibility not only the perpetrators of September the 11th, but also Taliban supporters, who attacked several of Mr. Fisk's fellow journalists in Afghanistan, all of whom, alas, died before being able to file a final column explaining why their murderers are blameless. Quite apart from the fact that most of my colleagues who died in Afghanistan were killed by thieves who had taken advantage of the Taliban's defeat, Stein's article was interesting for two reasons. It insinuated that I in some way approved of the crimes against humanity of September the 11th, or at the least would absolve the mass murderers. More importantly, the article would not have been written if I had not explained the context of the assault that was made on me, tiny though it was, of course, in the scale of suffering visited upon Afghanistan. Had I merely reported an attack by a mob, the story would have fitted neatly into the general American media presentation of the Afghan war. No reference to civilian deaths from US B-52 bombers, and no suggestion that the widespread casualties caused in the American raids would turn Afghans to fury against the West. We were, after all, were we not supposed to be liberating these people, not killing their relatives? Of course, my crime, the Journal gave its column the headline "Hate Me Crimes," was to report the why as well as the what and where. I was crossing the Atlantic on September the 11th. My plane took off from Belgium just after the first reports of the attack on the World Trade Center and turned round off the coast of Ireland when the US closed its airspace. So I filed my first column to the Independent from my airline seat on the plane's satellite phone, without notes, dictating to a copy taker, pointing out that there would be an attempt, I said in my article, in the coming days to avoid asking the why question. I wrote about the history of deceit and lies in the Middle East, about the Balfour Declaration, about Lawrence of Arabia's promises of independence to the Arabs. I wrote about the growing Arab anger at the deaths of thousands of Iraqi children under UN sanctions and the continued occupation of the West Bank and Gaza by Israel. I suggested bin Laden may have been responsible. I wrote that thousands of Muslims would soon die in Afghanistan as a result of the outrages in New York and Washington. Emails poured into the Independent, mostly in support of my article, many demanding my resignation. The attacks on America were caused by, I quote, hate itself of precisely the obsessive and dehumanizing kind that Fisk and bin Laden have been spreading. According to the same message from Professor Judea Pearl of UCLA, I was drooling venom and a professional hate peddler. Another missive, signed Ellen Popper, announced that I was in cahoots with the arch-terrorist bin Laden. This is 800 words, ladies and gentlemen, in an airline seat over the Atlantic. Mark Guon labelled me a total nutcase. I was psychotic, according to Lillian Barry Weiss. Brandon Heller of San Diego informed me that you are actually supporting evil itself. Quite a lot in 800 words. On an Irish radio show, a Harvard professor announced that I was a liar, a dangerous man, and that anti-Americanism, of which I was apparently guilty, was the same as anti-Semitism. The show's anchor eventually pulled the plug on the professor, but I got the point. Not only was it wicked to suggest that someone might have had reasons to commit the mass slaughter, it was even more appalling to suggest what these reasons might be. To criticise the United States, or to be anti-American, whatever that is, was to be a Jew-hater, a racist, a Nazi. Merely to suggest that Washington's policies in the Middle East, its unconditional support for Israel, its support for Arab dictators, its approval of UN sanctions, might lie behind the venomous attacks of September the 11th was an act of evil in itself. Oddly, the fact that the mass murderers were all Arabs and that most of them came from Saudi Arabia was not apparently regarded as a problem by reporters or by government. This fell into the where and what category. And Arab terrorists, of course, are very well known in Hollywood. The sin was to connect the Arabs with the problems of the lands they came from, to ask the why question. I think of this a lot because not just of the extraordinary, amazing preparations for the most powerful nation on earth, yours, to bomb the poorest, but because I was in Afghanistan 22 years ago to watch the Russian invasion of that country. How they fought for us, those Afghans, how they believed in our word, how they trusted President Carter when he promised the West support for Afghanistan once the war with Russia had been won. I even met the CIA's spook in Peshawar, brandishing the identity papers of a young Soviet pilot shot down with one of our Stinger missiles, which had been scooped from the wreckage of his MiG jet fighter. Poor guy, the CIA man said, before showing us a movie in his private home cinema about GIs zapping the Viet Cong. It was, I remember, a comedy film. And yes, I remember what the Soviet officers told me after arresting me at the Salang Tunnel north of Kabul, soldiers of the 3rd Soviet Parachute Brigade. They were performing, they said, their international duty in Afghanistan. They were punishing terrorists who wished to overthrow the Afghan government and destroy its people. Sound familiar? I should also tell you that one of the Soviet soldiers insisted that he liked the Beatles. And when I asked him how he understood about the Beatles, how he knew, he said, "We listen to Voice of America." I was working for the Times in 1980, and just south of Kabul, I picked up a very disturbing story. Remember, this is 22 years ago. A group of religious Mujahideen fighters had attacked a school because, so they had heard, the communist regime had forced girls to be educated in the same classroom as boys, and the girls no longer needed to wear veils. So the Mujahideen, who of course were on our side, had bombed the school, murdered the head teacher's wife, and cut her husband's head off. It was all true. I got down to the school, it was still smouldering, and what was left of the two bodies were hanging in a tree. But when my paper, at that time The Times, ran the story, the British Foreign Office quietly complained to my foreign editor at The Times that my report gave support to the Russians. Because in those days, of course, the Afghan fighters were the good guys. Because in those days, Osama bin Laden was one of the good guys. Charles Douglas Hume, then editor of The Times, would always insist that Afghan guerrillas were called freedom fighters in the headline. Your President Reagan once called them, once said they reminded him of the Founding Fathers. There was nothing you couldn't do with words. And so it is today. President Bush, of course, threatened the obscurantist, ignorant, super-conservative Taliban with the same punishment as he intended to mete out to bin Laden. Bush originally talked about justice and punishment, about bringing justice to the perpetrators of the New York and Washington atrocities. But he didn't send policemen to the Middle East. He sent B-52s and F-16s and AWACS planes and F-18s and A-10s and Apache helicopters. We were never going to arrest bin Laden. We were going to destroy him. But B-52s, as I wrote before the bombardment began, don't discriminate between men wearing turbans or between men and women or women and children. I say this because I have a particular interest in Osama bin Laden. Back in 1997, I met him, and not for the first time. I had interviewed him in Sudan in 1994, then in Afghanistan in 1996, then again the following year. That last night when we met, I was driven by one of his armed followers hundreds of miles across the mountains of Afghanistan, high up the rugged, towering Kabul Gorge. The clouds were below us, waterfalls of ice clinging to the rock above. One of his gunmen was driving the Toyota and turned to me at one point and said, "Toyota is good for holy war." Bin Laden would not have made a joke like that. After hours of sliding and slipping on the scree above sheer precipices, we reached a plateau of stones and rock where beside us was an air raid shelter 25 feet high and 25 feet wide, cut into the living rock of the mountainside by bin Laden's construction teams at the height of the war between the Afghans and the Russians. A war, of course, in which bin Laden had fought with great courage, being wounded 6 times, fighting, of course, on our side. Indeed, most of his camps, the camps at which the United States aimed its cruise missiles and bunker busters and daisy cutters and all the other infantile names we have for bombs last year, were long known and long on US tracking screens. The Americans knew exactly where all these locations were, and they should know because the Americans built them. The CIA constructed these camps, which we were told were now terror bases. Strange that that simple fact didn't make it into very many of your newspapers. Anyway, that night I waited in a tent along with several of bin Laden's armed followers. I have to say that in the months since September the 11th, I've wondered whether I sat next to Mohammed Atta or any of the suicide pilots to be. I have no idea, and I shall never know. Then bin Laden himself came in, lithe as a cat, but with a slight infirmity, I thought, in one of his feet. I was carrying over my shoulder a school satchel, which I use in rough countries to carry my passport and other documents. But bin Laden saw some Arabic language newspapers in the bag and seized upon them, turning to study them in the corner of the tent in silence for all of 20 minutes. He didn't even know that the Iranian foreign minister had just visited Saudi Arabia, his own country. And I sat there with his men, all of us ignored by bin Laden, and thought how isolated he seemed to be. Didn't he have a radio? Didn't he have a television? When he spoke, it was with a determination, a rather chilling self-conviction, which I had not seen before. I still have my notes of that meeting, and what he said is even more sinister in retrospect. "Mr. Robert," he said, "we fought and beat the Russian army in Afghanistan. We won our battle over the Russians from this very mountain upon which you are now sitting. And that battle destroyed the Soviet Union." From time to time, bin Laden, rather disconcertingly, would clean his teeth with a piece of mishwak wood while you were asking him questions. Then he said, "Mr. Robert, I pray to God that he will permit us to turn the United States into a shadow of itself." Ladies and gentlemen, I couldn't fail to remember those words when I saw those terrible images of New York on September the 11th back in Brussels. The World Trade Center disappeared into two almost biblical columns of smoke, and New York, I realized, was now a shadow of itself. Just one word made me feel deeply disturbed. But bin Laden's power in the Middle East comes, or came, from what he said rather than what he did. I don't think he climbs to the top of a mountain and pulls out a mobile phone and mutters, "Put Plan B into action." Hollywood might have him do that. I'm sure the State Department would. I fear, however, that his awful power and influence comes more from his words. Many times I have listened to them, personally present, his armed followers hanging upon those words as if he was a messiah. He would demand that the American forces leave the Middle East, leave what he called the land of the two holy places, Mecca and Medina, in Saudi Arabia. He demanded the end of what he called the corrupt regimes, which are supported by the West, Saudi Arabia itself, the other Arab Gulf countries, Egypt, Jordan, you know the rest, which torture their own people. He demanded an end to Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. He demanded an end to the sanctions, which are killing tens of thousands of Iraqi children. Whether or not he really felt that strongly, that is what he said. And his words do have a special resonance in an Arab world which has for decades felt humiliated by the West and especially by America. A world which many of its millions believe has indeed been corrupted and damaged almost beyond repair by the culture and armed might and politics of the West. Without those feelings of despair and humiliation and fury, bin Laden, I think, would truly be a voice in the wilderness, ignored and derided. But to many Arabs, and this is the point, to many Arabs who were appalled for both moral and religious reasons by the staggering massacres in New York and Washington, bin Laden does not sound insane, which is why his voice circulates clandestinely today, even now, on so many thousands of cassettes throughout the Middle East.
Journalist Robert Fisk of the Independent newspaper in Britain, he gave this speech and a speaking tour he recently gave in the United States. Democracy Now! Is produced in East Timor with Rick Rowley and Brad Simpson, also Deepa Fernandez and Simba Russo. In New York, Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner. Our engineer and music maestro is Anthony Sloan. From the Democratic Republic of East Timor, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.